I'm going to skip over some things that I say early on in the paper for the sake of saving a little time. I comment on the fact that metaphysics has had an interesting history, and sometimes it's been neglected, but I don't think it can be neglected. There are some basic questions about the world that we've got to ask, and when it comes to the issue of human freedom, one of the issues has always been, is this theory, causal determinism, a view about the world which I take to be an empirical theory, but which is hard to both disprove and prove? Is it incompatible with human freedom? And I'm going to suggest to you on this issue, now I'm usually not dogmatic, those of you who know me, on issues like this, but if you're going to make any sense of freedom, the outlines of the position that I'm going to give you today, I am absolutely convinced provide the only outlines on which you can make sense of human freedom. So either you make sense of it in these terms or there is none. That is, there is no freedom. I'm convinced that there is, so it's got to be in these outlines. So the question really is, does determinism conflict with freedom, or is it consistent with freedom? Now, it strikes me as extremely important that we have a correct account of what determinism is, and many of the confusions lie in the very nature of the case that people confuse determinism with other issues. Now, I want to say simply and somewhat informally that determinism is simply the view that there are patterns or regularities in the world, and that if we could come to understand what the patterns and regularities are and describe them correctly, and I left out here what we should have right there is laws, maybe we could have some laws that we express with these patterns and regularities, and that one might even be able then to explain events in the world. And if you can explain them, you can understand the world, at least that portion of it for which you give an explanation. The world is assumed on this definition to be rational, which simply means that it's intelligible or that you can give reasons for the things that happen. And if we can now give reasons, the assumption is made that some of the reasons may not yet have been discovered yet, but discovery is going to be a very important enterprise in science and elsewhere. So study is worthwhile. There are things that we can discover about the world. Well, if we can discover them, describe them, explain them, give reasons for them, it might even be possible to predict some things that are going to happen in the world. And I think that's true. Even though I'm not sure that we can predict everything, and it may be that we will never. It may be that things are in principle predictable, even though we will never be able to completely predict what human beings or God or anybody else is going to do. Now, what makes all of this possible? It's primarily the link between cause and effect. So that's why the view is often called causal determinism. Some of the causes may not be known. The relations between causes and effects may not be entirely understood. But because of this connection, determinism is often called causal determinism. And this is supported by the definition of determinism that follows, quote, determinism is the thesis that all human behavior is governed by causal laws. Now, I've tried to summarize these ideas with this little list. I think it does include those kinds of ideas. Most of you are determinists without knowing it. You wouldn't describe yourself as having a metaphysical theory because you're not sure, but what metaphysics may not be a dirty word, but you are determinists. Every discipline within a university, everything that is done within a university, is premised on the assumption that determinism is true. There would be absolutely no point in attending universities if you didn't try to discover something or understand or explain something. That's not only true in the physical and the life sciences, it's also true in the social sciences, even though we may not know the regularities. And even in the humanities, we must assume that determinism is true. The whole point in taking an English class in Joyce or Hemingway or some other great writer is that the teacher of the class has hopefully caught on to some of the patterns or regularities on the basis of which it's going to be worth your attending so that you can learn what they are and begin to pick up some things in your reading of some of those writers. Now, there is nothing in this complex of ideas that I have mentioned so far that suggests at all that determinism is incompatible with freedom. The realization that causes produce effects does not mean that one can't change the causes, and that doing so may not be part of what freedom is about. What frequently happens, however, is that determinism is confused with fatalism. Now, I am sure that fatalism is totally incompatible with freedom. So if one confuses determinism and fatalism, it shouldn't be surprising that people would then say that determinism is incompatible with freedom. That is, if you run these two together, it would be easy to say that determinism is incompatible with freedom. If you keep them apart, however, I'm suggesting that that's not the case. Fatalism is the view, it seems to me, that everything that happens has in some sense been pre-rigged or pre-arranged so that nature is assumed, or whatever it is, to have so arranged all actions and events in the world so that nothing that we can immediately do now will alter or change the outcome of any events. And I think that's the key assumption that one has to understand under fatalism. Nothing that we do now can change anything. There are a variety of ways that people have described this. People sometimes say, when your number is up, it's up. And it doesn't make any difference what you are doing or what you are trying to do, that nothing that you can do will alter or change the outcome of fated events. The soldier on the battlefield would then believe that it would not make any difference whether you stay down in your foxhole or get up and run toward the enemy. If there is a bullet that has your number on it, that bullet would even go around corners and down in your foxhole to get you. Right? So that what you do will not affect anything. Now, some people strangely find comfort in this view. Whatever happens, they assume they couldn't change it or alter it in any way, and they may as well accept the events. So resignation often goes along with fatalism. If one sees poverty or disease or death, one may as well not worry about it since there's nothing that we can do about it. Now, let me tell you clearly that I do not care for such a position. The reason is, of course, that there is no freedom in such a worldview, and if there is no freedom, there is no responsibility. No one is responsible for anybody else or for what they themselves do. Anciently, the Stoics believed that all of the events in the world were happened to happen the way they happen, and there was nothing that one could do to alter them with one exception. One could reorient one's mind to accept whatever happened instead of becoming bitter or angry or to kick against the pricks. So there was some freedom within Stoicism. One had the freedom to orient one's mind in this manner. If, however, the orientation of the mind is fated, then there is no freedom whatsoever. Predestination, the next view, is simply an explicitly theological version of fatalism. In predestination, however, everything is prearranged by God. In this view, the natural laws and the moral laws are all created by God, and all creatures are created by God ex nihilo, out of nothing, to be whatever God predestines them to be. As in Augustine's theology, if you are predestined to be damned, you will be damned no matter how good you try to be, because your trying has no bearing on whether or not you will be saved. These are the people that Augustine described with the phrase, the Latin phrase, posse pecare. It is possible to sin. Well, not only was it possible for this group of people to sin, it was impossible for them not to sin. They had to sin. They must sin, whether they want to or not, since they are predestined to be among the damned. Now, on such a view, there is no sense that one can make of human freedom. Even though this is a parenthetical remark, Augustine tries to make sense of freedom, I think one has to admit, in looking at Augustine's theology, that he totally and completely fails. Now, one of the attractive aspects of predestination for some people is that it can explain the complete and total omniscience of God. I have elsewhere argued, in fact 2 years ago in the same symposium, that this is an idea Mormons do not accept, in the sense that it is taken in Catholic Protestant theology, and I surely hope that Mormons don't accept predestination doctrine either as an excuse for adopting omniscience, this kind of total and complete omniscience, because on both notions there is no sense that one can make of human freedom. Okay, let me go on. Now, sometimes foreordination is described in a way that makes it sound similar to predestination. In order to provide for human freedom, it is extremely important to distinguish these two ideas. The important difference is briefly that no one must accept any obligation or responsibility, even if they are foreordained to it. Acceptance is voluntary, and it is conditioned on principles of righteousness, which themselves assume real choices and volition. Now, some writers have been so frustrated with fatalism, predestination, and determinism, especially if they combine and confuse them, that they search for an alternative in order to make sense of freedom. The alternative is supposed to be indeterminism. Indeterminism would then deny that there are any patterns or regularities in the world. It would deny laws, explanations, predictions, understanding of the world, even discovery of trends or patterns in the world. Causality goes out on this theory. There are no causal relations. In short, the world is characterized by chance and by randomness. Now, what too many writers have not recognized and have not thought about deeply enough is that this view does not in any way provide for human freedom. If, for example, I wanted to walk across a room, there is no guarantee that I would make it, or that the room will even be there. The other side of the room will be there by the time I get there, you know. Strange things can happen. I begin to walk and my leg may flip out to the side and toss me on my head or something like that. So random or chance circumstances may intervene to prevent my doing what I want to do, and there is absolutely no way to make any sense of freedom on this indeterminist position. It is surprising and a little perplexing to me that anyone would seriously entertain this idea that there is freedom here, when it is so obviously the case that there is not. And one person, a famous philosopher who did seriously entertain that idea, was the great French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre, who is absolutely wrong about this view. You know, there just isn't any freedom there, in spite of all of the discussion that Sartre in his lifetime devoted to talking about human freedom. Now, the world on this view is completely irrational and no one can understand anything. It may be fun for the novice Zen Buddhist monks to be given koans, that is, puzzles that don't have solutions, so that these novice monks will quit trying to find answers to questions. But in general, I'm convinced that such an attitude doesn't benefit man or society, and it ought to be rejected, and it especially ought to be rejected in Mormonism, where there has been a very strong rational tradition. Well, let's summarize the argument so far. Under fatalism, predestination, and indeterminism, there's no possibility to make any sense of freedom. The only remaining possibility, then, is to see if we can make sense of freedom with determinism. Given the description of determinism that has been given so far, there is furthermore no incompatibility between freedom and determinism. If determinism is carefully differentiated from fatalism and some other confusions are avoided, and there are many, and I'm not going to try to explain them all, there is no reason to suppose that we have a problem in accepting determinism. What does it mean for an act to be free? Well, one thing that it means is that I can do what I want to do, that I can translate my wants or desires or intentions into action. It cannot mean that my act is uncaused, for then there is no connection between the act and me, such that my reasons or intentions brought it about that the act was done. In a famous article, W.T. Stace makes this point and points out that all actions are causes. The free acts are those that are caused by me, by my internal psychological states, and the unfree acts also are determined. They are caused by events or circumstances external to me, things that condition me. Both the free and the unfree acts are therefore determined. They have causes. Unless they do have causes that lie within me, I cannot claim them to be my acts. Now, one of the sources of problems on this topic, seems to me, is one that even Stace himself is subject to. Stace and others have supposed that freedom is an all-or-nothing proposition, that one either has complete freedom or no freedom at all. It is supposedly similar to determinations in a court of law. The finding is guilty or not guilty. And in the same way, people assume that one is free or unfree. The real situation is much more complex. In every act that we perform, there is a variety of different factors that bear on us in complex ways. Some of them limit our options and choices. Others may increase our options. Freedom is therefore a matter of degrees, and there are wide ranges of these degrees. And I would diagram that situation in this way. As long as a person is alive, I believe that no one, no matter how constraining the circumstances, is completely unfree. Now, I'm not sure that I can say, however, what it would mean to be completely unfree. On the other hand, I'm also confident that no one is completely without constraints, or in other words, completely free. The interesting thing to do is to talk about some factors that I think will increase one's freedom within this range in here, or decrease one's freedom. Now, this conception allows me to make an even stronger claim. Not only is it true that freedom is compatible with determinism, unless we believe in determinism, we cannot in any sense make sense of freedom. Freedom requires determinism as a concomitant. It is at this point that I need to forestall some confusions. One, even though it is approximately true to say that free acts are those whose causes lie within, as Aristotle and Stace would say, it is also true that internality does not guarantee freedom. Using the degrees of freedom described here, it is clear that a person with compulsions or psychoses or neuroses is not as free as a person without the compulsions in regard to the actions that are influenced by those compulsions. What would be useful and important would be to say what factors would increase freedom, what factors decrease it. More about this shortly. 2. Some people have supposed that if a person does a certain thing, then that person could not have done otherwise. Those of you who've read some of the literature know this famous phrase, the person could not have done otherwise. Or to complicate the argument a little, if a person did what he wanted to do so that he could not have done otherwise unless he had wanted to, one goes on to say then, he could not have wanted to do otherwise than he did. So you simply push the argument back one further step. The mistake in such argumentation arises in at least two ways, one logical and one numerical. First, from the fact that a person does a certain thing, it does not follow logically or metaphysically or in any other way that I can see that he could not have done otherwise. The only thing that follows, given the act performed, is that he did not do otherwise. Could is a disposition word. The only way that one can show from an act performed that one could not have done otherwise would be to show that the person has or had only one disposition. Now, this would be an empirical claim. I don't know how one would show it, but I think it would be an empirical claim and not a logical one. Furthermore, I would suggest it is patently false that any person has only one disposition or reason for acting at any time in his or her life. The usual situation is that several different acts are overdetermined. That is, that there are adequate causes within me for me to do several things right now. Right now, I have some reasons to raise my hand or to shout or to sit down, etc. I hold these reasons with different strengths, and some of them are opposed by contrary reasons, and so that I can decide to overrule them or not using those contrary reasons. In much the same way that people have dogmatically claimed in the past that we are either free or unfree, and hence focus on a two-state theory, in regard to the above argument, they focus on the one unique act performed and suppose that it could have been done from only one set of reasons, and that other sets of reasons might not have equally well been overdetermined. That is, that they could not have done the same act from other sets of reasons. And I want to say that such is blatantly not the case. One and the same person can perform an act of a certain sort for many different dispositions or reasons, and other persons can perform that act or an act of that sort for very different reasons. 3. Another common suggestion is that ultimately, if one traces chains of causation back far enough, they all originate externally, external to me at least, and that all acts are therefore unfree. For example, the fact that I am here has something to do with choices and decisions made by my parents before I was conceived or born. Therefore, all causation is ultimately external. In Orthodox Christian theology, this idea can be carried even further. Since God is the creator of all out of nothing but himself, the only ultimate and external cause of importance is God. There's a very important sense in which this is not true in Mormon theology, as I will mention later. What is important here, however, is this. The mere fact that all causation can be traced outside of the person ultimately does not affect my conception of degrees of freedom or unfreedom. The reason is that it becomes very important to see how long these chains of causation have been within the person and in what way to see to what extent one is relatively free or unfree. Now, this brings me to consideration of some of the factors that affect the amount of freedom that a person has. All of these factors, it seems to me, can also be arranged by degrees on a continuum. I wish to claim, for example, that the more experience or knowledge a person has, the freer the person is. A child is not, therefore, as free as an adult in a very important way. Even though the child is free to run in front of an automobile, this act may be the last free act that the child does. An adult knowing what automobiles can do to free people, that is, immortality. Adults knowing what automobiles can do to people, that is, knowing the consequences of certain acts and wishing to avoid those consequences, some ranges of action remain open to the individual, chooses not to run in front of cars. Likewise, knowing which kinds of things may be hot and avoiding touching them opens to the person of experience other options and ensures the avoidance of undesirable and unanticipated pain. In general, that is hopefully one thing that education, the acquiring of knowledge, will do for people. This involves learning what things cause what and with what consequences. Other important factors would be imagination, certain relatively external factors such as socioeconomic circumstances, health, climate, and so on. Since it should be apparent how these could affect a person and how they may to some extent be altered by the individual himself as he responds to them, I'm not going to spend further time discussing them here. One very important factor that I would like to mention is time. If one is driving carefully down the road at reasonable or safe speeds, and a child emerges from behind an object, obscuring one's vision, where the object was obscuring your vision, into the path of the car, and the amount of time between when one sees the child and collides with the child is so short that no evasive action could be taken, then one is not free to have avoided the child. However, if the child emerges onto the roadway far down the road, then one has the opportunity to perceive that, have that record on your brain, get back to your muscle coordination, stop, drive around the child, and pursue many other different alternatives. One important difference in the two cases is the amount of time one has to consider alternatives and take appropriate action. Time is in fact so important that it is viewed as the key factor in courts of law in determining whether a person is charged with first-degree murder. Okay, in summary to this point, we can now sketch some of these factors in this way. Although the correlations are not perfect and may be complicated by other factors, I would say in general, as knowledge, imagination, and time increase in this way, so also does freedom. In general. And in addition, there is one more and one very important factor that we ought to add to this list, that's responsibility. As Moritz Schlick in an excellent article some years ago suggested, this may be the most interesting aspect of this whole discussion, the most important correlation of all. And in this article, Schlick discusses some of the important confusions that people have led people to say that there is no responsibility because there is no freedom because of some of these other metaphysical views. Having described now in broad outlines the main issues in this very old debate, we can draw some consequences. Most people do believe in determinism in the sense in which I have described it. There is nothing in determinism which precludes our believing in freedom. Our common feeling that we are free, at least to some extent, is vindicated by the observation that it is compatible with determinism. This position is technically called soft determinism. Even though all actions are caused, some of them are caused by us and in ways that we can describe as more or less free, depending on the factors or circumstances that go into the acts. Furthermore, in order to assess praise or blame or responsibility, we need to know a lot about the causal history of the person who does the act. How long have the causes been within the agent and in what way has to do with the way we assess the causal history of the agent. It is at this point that a discussion of some central notions in Christian theology becomes important. I've already mentioned that in Orthodox Catholic Protestant theology, the assumption is made that God is the creator of all, that this creation is ex nihilo, out of nothing, and that as a consequence one sees that God is the one and only necessary being. Now, a necessary being is a being who could not exist. A being who must exist, who did not come into existence. Now, a necessary being is a being who could not exist. A being who must exist, who did not come into existence, and who could not go out of existence. All other persons or beings are contingent. That is, they could not exist. They did come into existence and could, if God desired, go out of existence. This is not to say that they will or that Christians believe that they will, but only that their contingency logically makes it possible that they could cease to exist. Such conceptions makes it possible to distinguish between a creator and the other beings who are created. Many writers have believed that God must continually prop up his creation to maintain the contingent beings in existence. Without his sustaining influence, these contingent beings might literally pop out of existence. Such a position provides a rationale to the deep philosophical anxiety that existentialists feel about life. They say that they discover their existence, are perplexed about what they should do with it, and in all of this, the central fact that constantly confronts them is that we must die. Not knowing when or why, and not without having worked out for ourselves what we should be doing with our existence. But most important of all is the fact that death may represent the complete and total annihilation of existence. Now, this would be possible only if we are contingent beings whose existence can be annihilated. If one rejects this crucial existential assumption, as Mormons do, the vaunted existential dread slinks into the corner and under careful examination melts away. In all of these matters, there is surprisingly little appreciation among both Mormons and non-Mormons as to how dramatically different Mormon theological conceptions are from the Orthodox Christian views. I think that's still true even within the church, even within Mormonism. And in a footnote, I point still to Sterling McMurrin's great book on the foundations of theology in the Mormon religion, a book that I still think is the best one on the topic and very valuable. Now, Mormons do not believe in an ex nihilo creation. Technically, they do not even believe in creation. If that is taken to mean making something from nothing, rather, they believe in God's organizing work, taking coexisting elements, and ordering them under some constraints determined by those very elements. What is for our purposes more important, however, is the view that each individual is a necessary being in some sense, who has not come into existence, nor can it ever go out of existence. It is in this context that we can introduce a distinction between what is called free agency or free will on the one hand and freedom on the other. If we view free agency as an inherent capacity to make choices, the capacity, then freedom describes the making of them, the circumstances, and the consequences of the decisions made. In Orthodox Christian theology, there is a real sense in which free agency is so truncated as to be meaningless. That is, of course, why it is often difficult to make sense of freedom within this traditional Orthodox theological tradition. If God has made or created me, then the arena for choice is determined by God, as is my constitution. And these two factors suggest such strong external constraints that it is not surprising that predestination ideas are ever present in this tradition. If, on the other hand, God knows everything that I am going to do by virtue of being outside of time, then my entire future is determined by God's knowledge of what is true, and I am in no sense free, nor do I have even the capacity for free choice, which is what we mean by free agency. Now, these ideas in this Catholic tradition are not in the Mormon tradition deriving from Joseph Smith. Doctrine and Covenants 93, verse 29, man was also in the beginning with God. Intelligence, or the light of truth, was not created or made, neither indeed can be. B.H. Roberts emphasized the implications of this view when he wrote, quote, intelligences are not created or made, for they are eternal. Eternal is God the Father and God the Son. In this context, there can be, incidentally, no original sin, because there is no origin. Roberts further observes that these intelligences are, quote, endowed as they are with free will. Now, free will is, I assume here, what I have called free agency. Roberts summarizes some of these properties as of individual intelligence as immortal, self-existent, uncreated, and eternal as God is. The best account of intelligences that I know of is Roberts' The 70s Course on Theology. This was given from 1905 to 1912. It's not very widely available, but you can get your hands on it. Such entities, Roberts says, in the second year manual, must be self-conscious, which means having the power to distinguish himself from other things, the me and the not me. But in addition, as an inherent power, such entities must have, as Roberts says, quote, the power of deliberation, end quote, and the power, quote, to form a judgment that this or that is a better thing or state than this or that, end quote. In the fourth year of this same course on theology, Roberts adds one more very important quality. Intelligences have the power of volition. Quote, intelligence as embodied in man is also conscious of the power within certain limits to will and perform what he wills to do, end quote. Furthermore, quote, having deliberated, he and individual intelligence has the power to choose between them, so that volition, within certain limits at least, seems also to be a quality of intelligence, end quote. The Book of Moses suggests that all of the above described traits require some knowledge, because when spirits were made to give the intelligences an arena for action, Enoch was told that the intelligences were given, quote, their knowledge, end quote. See the Pearl of Great Price, Moses 7 and 32. Such views are given credence, especially by the great King Follett discourse of Joseph Smith, now carefully presented in the several different accounts of Diarus in the new book, The Words of Joseph Smith. What emerges all out of all of this in Mormon thought is individuals are not simply a product of their genetic inheritance and their environment. There is a part of the person that did not originate externally, whose causes were, ever were, and are internal to that person. It is an egregious mistake to then talk of free agency being given to man. That's a mistake. It's a very bad one, a very misleading and confusing one. Certain enabling capacities, such as a spiritual body and a mortal body, were in some sense given to man in order to provide additional opportunities for growth in knowledge and freedom. But the free agency itself was co-eternal, necessary, and indestructibly always a part of the person, so that it could not be given. In his excellent article, Martin Clark, that was in Dialogue, incidentally, some years ago, Martin Clark is right when he says that Satan's plan was no real alternative. If we view it as being possible to completely take away our free agency, that was not a real alternative. We've got to view it in some other way. In a real sense, the free agency of man potentially and also actually conditions God, as does the free agency of God provide an external conditioning factor for each agent. Freedom in Mormon thought does not come about only through the overdetermination of events, as I describe it here. It arises out of the very nature of each individual as an inherent quality or capacity for action, which when actualized does not require conditioning by anything else outside of it in order to act. Such a view places on man a correspondingly heavy burden of responsibility for the use of this capacity, and cannot be escaped by blaming actions on others or on original sin, or Satan for that matter. You know, that's an easy cop-out. The devil made me do it. Doesn't work for Mormons. Martin Clark dramatizes this better in his article than anyone else I have read. In addition, there is the assumption of the eternality of experience and substantial knowledge that goes beyond this mortal life. If the suggestion made earlier was correct, that as knowledge increases, so also does freedom, then this enlarges freedom in Mormon thought beyond this general conception that I presented. In another way, freedom is enhanced in Mormon thought if time is a key factor in reasoned deliberations, and if intelligences have had a virtual eternality of time. Then freedom, and with it responsibility, is awesome and unavoidable. Thank you.
Now let me tell you, this is not a written response to what Kent has said. This is his talk he gave me the other evening, so that I could read it over and make an intelligent reaction to what he said. So don't worry about my reading this word for word. I'm not going to do that. Now I want to also apologize to you for the fact that I am not omniscient. I do not know all of the answers to these very, very disturbing questions that have come up in the course of the last hour. But I will confess that I am a hardcore determinist. Now, what do I mean by that? I think that you should be aware of the fact that hardcore determinists have been categorized by general authorities as corruptors of youth. And this implies right from the beginning that if you discriminate enough to separate the meaning of free agency from free will, you get in trouble. As a hardcore determinist, I can still tolerate free agency. That is not a contradiction. It is my way of thinking. Now, also keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that when we talk about matters like freedom of the will and freedom as an agent and eternal progression and innate tendencies or characteristics, you've got so many words, so many thoughts, so many ideas that the ultimate situation is semantical confusion. And this has gone on from Socrates. Do you know when he lived? When did Socrates live?
About 600
BC. No. 600 BC, 5th century BC, 4th century BC, around that time, before Christ. From Socrates through the Christian period of time, through the medieval period of time, through the Renaissance, through the Reformation, through the Age of Reason, up to the present time, there has been no satisfactory definition sufficient to prevent ongoing verbal arguments as to what is meant by determinism or freedom of the will. But I want to say to Dr. Robeson that with one or two minor exceptions, I agree with what you've said. And I liked your talk very much. I read this over. I read it to my wife, who couldn't be here today. She says, I've got to meet that man. So you may come over sometime for dinner, and I'll let you meet my wife. Now, I'd like to take his paper, and I know that time is pressing now, and you're probably tired after a whole day of hearing pros and cons. I want to take his paper and call attention to one or two things, then I'll sit down and let you have the time to ask him some questions yourselves. What is determinism? Now, I don't know whether you got Dr. Robeson's definition of determinism or not. Did you? What did he say? What is his definition of determinism? Was it clear? Was it satisfactory? Was it logical? I think he's guilty of a little begging of the question now and then, Petitio Principii, if you don't mind that, sir. But by and large, I think he would agree. Let me put it concisely. From my point of view, and I teach this subject time and time again, quarter after quarter, have been for 20 years, for me, determinism can be best defined like this, and I give credit to Brand Blanchard, did I say that correctly, who was one of America's great, is he still alive?
No,
I don't think so, but he was here not so many years ago. And he stood up before a group of people and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I must confess to you that I am a determinist. Then he paused. You should have seen the reaction on the part of the group. He said, what I mean by determinism is every event, mental or physical, has a cause. That's it. Simply put, every event, mental or physical, has a cause. That means outside and inside contexts. Now, when I deal with the causal context, I am involved in an ad infinitum aspect of ascertaining cause of cause of cause of cause. If I stand before you 6'6", blue eyes, limited intelligence, no ability to sing, no ability to do much of anything that'll make money, then I'm saying that I am limited in my function. I have been caused to be what I am by virtue of genes and environment. Dr. Kent, implies that self-determinism is the area in which he wants to make the best definition of freedom. I determine my own causes. That may be true. I can't disagree with that. But if at any moment I go into a coffee shop and ask for a black cup of coffee, I have a reason for using black coffee instead of coffee with cream. But I can't tell you why. Or some young lady may decide that she wants as her date someone who's so tall, has so much ability, and so on and so forth, and she has reasons for that. But at the moment, it would be impossible for anyone except an omniscient being to ascertain the cause of 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 the cause. So you get involved in what Immanuel Kant called a palpable antinomy. You go back to the first cause, and if you imply a first cause, you imply a cause that hasn't a cause, and you negate your whole causal argument. So we can't, by virtue of limited perspective, ascertain all causes. And I think that's why when someone is doing something we consider wrong, we'd better be very careful about making a judgment. We don't know all of the causes of that immediate act, even though we have enough intelligence to analyze it and say it was bad, or it was good. You see what I'm talking about? Now, if I can go back to the definition. For me, determinism is simply all events, mental or physical, have a cause. And if that event, mental or physical, is caused, it is determined by that cause. Now, I must also say, and this is something that is in opposition to what Kant said, I think that free will and determinism are mutually exclusive. If you say, looking at a dam, and this may be a lousy metaphor, but I use it because it's the best thing that comes to my mind at the moment, which is determined. If I look at a dam, and I'm told that dam is completely leak-free, I say the dam is leak-free. I can't see any major hole in the dam. But if there's one microscopic leak in that huge dam, it is not leak-free. Likewise, if there is one instance of indeterminism, which could be chance or randomness, then there is no total cosmic order. That's the way I approach that problem. They are mutually exclusive. Okay, that's one thing I want to talk about. Determinism is the thesis that all human behavior is governed by causal laws. I say amen to that. I loved it when I saw every event has a cause. I want to add these words, or did they take them off? No, they were in the preceding discussion. What I mean by a caused event is that every particular event has necessary and sufficient antecedent circumstances that make it what it is, which leads to my next criticism in response to the previous lecture. I explain to my students, and I think this is very important, that by determinism I mean, in terms of human behavior, that whenever anyone, male or female, commits an act, or thinks a thought, at the time that thought or act is committed, that is the only thought or act, that person, under those circumstances, being what he or she is, could have done at that time. Now that's in opposition to what Kant said a moment ago, I think. I want to insist that whatever I do at any moment I do it is the only thing I could have done at that time under those circumstances. You, at that time, of course we couldn't both occupy the same physical space, so we've got different context. Now this is a problem you can't solve with words. But I think I could defend my position in insisting that whatever a person does at the time he does, it's the only thing he or she could have done at that time under those circumstances. That's another way to describe determinism. Last but not least, I wanted to call attention to the fact that eternal progression is one of the things I love about Mormon doctrine. I have my problems with Mormon doctrine, but I like the idea of eternal progression. That means there is no end set time for movement forward. So, going to Hegel and what Kant said a moment ago, the more we learn about the laws that exist, the freer we are from the inadvertent infraction of those laws. So the more a man or a woman acquires in the way of knowledge about laws, assuming this is a cosmic universe, I don't think there's anybody in this room who's going to deny the criticism that Kant made of indeterminism when it's described as no cause. That's caprice, chance. No one wants to accept that kind of doctrine. The more we learn about law, said Hegel, that remarkable German philosopher who influenced Darwin and a lot of other people, the freer we become. And it was Paul, St. Paul, who said the same thing. The more you learn about God's laws, the freer you become. And the Mormon Church teaches explicitly that there is a law irrevocably decreed in heaven before the foundation of the earth, now I want to make a paraphrase here, upon which all cause and effect is present. Now that's my interpretation. So, when you leave this life, whether you're male or female, I wish I could have made a response to the last session, that the assumption that our essence in the pre-existence negates being male or female, to me, is Mormon stupidity, not enlightenment. I won't go into that. However, I want to say this, that whether we're male or female, the degree of achievement in knowing is progression. And because there is no end to it, everlasting progression is our goal. That's very satisfying, stimulating, and enlightening. Freedom, to me, has to be defined as being free to do what I want to do. If I want to do something that's positive, I could trace that back to circumstances that lead up to that positive act. But there's no way for me to ascertain why I did what I did at the time I did it, because that involves the complex ad infinitum causal complex. You see what I'm talking about here? But eternal progression allows constant ongoingness, and the more we learn, the more our wanting will be positive, and the more we'll go on. Now let me conclude by saying this. I differentiate between free agency and freedom of the will. I can be a determinist in regard to will and still be an advocate of free agency. So I say it like this, and I'll conclude. You may be free to do as you please because no one is constraining you. Supposing I want to say goodbye and walk out. That would be acting as a free agent. But you're going to say, why did you want to walk out? Now, if I want to walk out and somebody says, no, you can't go till you explain this dilemma. You've left us all confused. Stay and explain. Then, wanting to leave and not being able to leave makes me lack free agency. I am constrained to stay. But as long as there's no outward constraint, whether it's a gun, a threat, whatever, grades in the class, whatever may compel you to not do what you want to do, then you are to that extent, to that degree, not a free agent. But that is not the same as freedom or determination of the will. You may be free to do as you please if you're not constrained. This is my final statement. But you are not free to please as you please. That's a matter of genetics and environmental experience. Thank you.